Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I'm delighted to be hosting this special series of the Emerge Australia podcasts during Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and overlapping associated conditions. This series is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign. Designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed post 30th of November. To commence today, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the wonderful lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, I can't help to imagine a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally. And for our listeners, a world without stigma or discrimination, a world where we have equity of access to treatments, clinical and patient services, as well as biomarkers, diagnostic tests, and, dare I dream, a cure. Today, I'm delighted to have a very special guest with us, Dr. David Feinberg. David is an accomplished general practitioner and PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne. He's deeply involved in research and clinical care for complex conditions such as ME/CFS, long COVID, POTS, and other neuroimmune disorders. He's the founder of the ME Research Clinic, where he combines patient-centered care with cutting-edge research to improve diagnosis and treatment options. His work spans across multiple disciplines, including genomics, metabolomics and advanced neuroimaging, all aimed at understanding the underlying mechanisms of these often under-recognized conditions. Dr. Feinberg also plays a key role in national initiatives to elevate clinical standards and support for clinicians managing these complex illnesses. Today, I'm really excited to delve into his insights on the latest research, treatment approaches, and the future of personalised medicine in ME/CFS and related conditions. So without further ado, welcome Dr. David Feinberg.
Thank you very much, Anne. What a wonderful introduction. I have to admit that is some really amazing stuff that we're doing, but they're big picture things and they're long project things. So a lot of that stuff we will get to in time, and small steps is basically how I feel that wonderful introduction is truly amazing. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Oh, that's a pleasure. And small steps are fine, you know. You don't get to big things by just leaping onto a mountain from the ground. You've just got to make baby steps. And sometimes in those baby steps, you take a couple of steps forward and a couple of baby steps back. The thing is that we get there in the end. And for people with ME/CFS, of course, as you know, that cannot come quick enough.
Very true. Very true.
So to kick us off, Can you tell us a little bit more about your journey into researching complex chronic illnesses like ME/CFS and long COVID, and what drew you to this field?
I think everyone has a really interesting journey into this space. And a lot came to it from the pandemic, but I think my journey starts well and truly before. And the only way I can describe it, if I was to, in one word, just put it all together, it was basically the people that drew me to it, the people that were suffering with the illness. And what I noticed over my training years, that I would come into contact with people who had ME/CFS, and they were truly remarkable people. One was a trainee GP, and he was brilliant, but he was so afflicted by the illness, it held him up and it held him from his true potential. And as time went on, it, honestly, he had a huge and profound impact just seeing him. But as I went forwards, I had patients with the illness. They were amazing people. And as time went on, I went and did work in different spaces. So I've gone from my emergency training days to my GP days. And now I'm working more in the GP. I'm fully trained in my GP space and I'm having patients and I'm like, well, we can't really do much. There's not much out there. So we just supported them and we treated the comorbid illnesses. And then I was doing some work for the military and I was a contracted doctor there and we have amazing records. So you could go back from 30 years, and this is unlike we've got in normal medicine. It was so well documented. You could see their infections. You could see where they'd been at the time in these unusual spaces. And as I'm trying to treat these people, because the military has a very adversarial health system with their patients, it's very hard from a GP to try and be on the side of your patient. And so I'm trying to really help these people, and I couldn't find much out there. There wasn't much out there. And these were truly amazing people. I'm like, we've got to do something. So I'm trying to reach out, I'm trying to find people. And I came across Chris Armstrong, who, quite frankly, is very inspirational and is truly an amazing person who seems to have this gravity where he just accumulates amazing teams. And when you meet him, you're like, if someone's going to do something here, if someone's going to cure this illness, it's going to be him. So I'm sitting there and I'm talking with him about it and I'm trying to find good practitioners and what tests we do. And then my friend, me and this guy, we used to work at the military barracks together. We'd run around the town at lunchtime, the botanical garden. And one day he gets sick with it. And I see him in hospital. I'm like, mate, you've got long COVID. You've got chronic fatigue syndrome. And then it became really personal for me. And I got to this nexus in my life where it was either follow this pathway of you know, public service, like public servant sort of work, or go back to general practice and maybe do something more and bigger picture. And so I go to Chris, I go, let's do something with this. Let's learn more. And he's like, all right, come and do research with me. So I thought, you know what, if I'm going to learn about this illness, if I'm going to learn how to actually treat people with it, might as well do some research, do it formal. And so I signed up for the PhD. And that was basically my journey. And then I think with everyone's journey in a PhD, you become very obsessed with the illness and you just learn everything about it. And, you know, the more I learn about it, the more I'm like, how is this illness that affects so many amazing people? And it's not, these are really, their potential is huge, but how do we have an illness that impacts so many people? How does it attract so little funding, so little recognition and so much stigma? And it's just baffling. And I think that's what draws me to it, is because there is so much potential here to make very minimal impact that has huge outcomes. But also it's the people. Like, I just find them, they're amazing. I don't know, maybe there's a lot there that they just feel like they're my people. And in that way, I want to help them, and they don't ask for a lot, which is unusual for a population that's so afflicted. They don't want a lot from us. They just don't want to be stigmatized and, you know, looked down upon. So quite often you don't even need to do much to help in that therapeutic relationship. But I find it immensely satisfying. And, you know, I've sort of geared my whole life around the research and the practice of it, and you know, trying to accumulate teams and move in the right direction. But, you know, the journey is really at the start. I mean, I'm only, depends where you think the start of the journey is, but only, you know, 5 or 6 years into a lifelong learning journey.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you raised so many points that straight away have me going off script. So the first one is the amazing people and the amazing patients. So I've been in healthcare as a CEO now for well over 25 years, working across, you know, nephrology, respiratory care, and now I'm in this field. And we have on our database at Emerge Australia so many healthcare professionals with ME, not just with ME, but severe ME, so they're bedbound. And it's like, are you for real? And the caliber of person with severe ME that we hear from, there are, first of all, the people are beautiful. Secondly, there are just so many professional people who, you know, have been active, etc., and have given up everything because of this horrible condition for which we have no cure, for which, generally speaking, no one believes in. And you hear stories. So we hear stories from all of our patients, whether they are students, whether they are carers, whether they are people at university who are studying, whether they're healthcare professionals, any other care professionals, mums, dads, grandparents, we hear it all. And I think the one thing, and this resonated with what you were saying for me, is that it is so important that patients experience from healthcare professionals, and that's validation. They just want to be believed. And a lot of patients understand that we don't yet have a cure. We don't have a one-size-fits-all and probably never will. But if they feel that their healthcare professional believes them and understands and makes them feel valued, that goes a hell of a long way. And it sounds to me as though what you've just said is what you believe.
Very much. We need to value people. But I think as medical practitioners, we should always believe our patients. I feel like I remember somewhere along a journey that being a very core tenet of the patients are not lying to you. They're very real. What they're going through is true. And we believe our patients and we should always believe them. And that is very core to general practice. And I do a lot of examining for the College of GPs. So it is hard for me to see and hear people's experiences and out of tune they are with what the current model of general practice is in this country. And I know the GP college has seen a lot of development and growth over the years. And I wonder whether that plays into, you know, the generation that are coming through now, because a lot of my colleagues my age are very, they all understand the illness. And this is even if we go pre-pandemic, before it was really quite obvious. But I feel like we were trained in it and we saw it. We knew a bit more purely because our ethos was believe the patients and the empathy was almost assessed as entry into medical programs. So I wonder whether that changes things and that will, regardless of any intervention, change people's experiences here. But we need to believe them always. No matter what's going on, you should believe them.
And we need more doctors like yourself to stand up and say, we need to believe our patients, because I can tell you, you've seen me many times at GPCE, and now Emerge Australia does our clinical education with Health Ed. So we are there at most Health Ed conferences around the country where people like Associate Professor Bernard Hsu, Dr. Jason Lamb and others will do clinical education. When we talk to GPs who attend those conferences, sometimes we get shocked by clinicians who tell us, we don't want to treat these patients, it's all in their heads. One doctor recently said to me, I don't need to know anything about this because I work in aged care. The reality of what we hear is very often the reality of what patients actually experience. So I do hope that what you're saying in terms of the new generation of clinicians that are coming through do actually listen to their patients, because I don't think we'd be delivering as much GP education if we received that kind of a response at these conferences. We actually receive the contrary, and that's a concern to us.
But that's also a very interesting point. And I think there's two things that I want to touch on from what you said there. And number one is the aged care comment. And people with this illness are across all ages. It's just as we get a bit older, the ME/CFS sort of forced pacing, basically. As people start to suffer from their other comorbidities, they sort of wind back. And those other comorbidities seem to reduce and explain away functional loss. But the issue with that is what we're losing in our aged care people with ME/CFS is the old system of the matriarch, where, and the only reason I bring up the matriarch and not the patriarch is purely because of our 80-20 population breakup. But we need the old versions where our grandparents and our great-grandparents were providing the wisdom and the guidance that our younger generations need, providing that family, that unit, the nuclear family. And I think that we've lost a lot of that. And that is my big fear with ME/CFS. And that's why I'm so aggressive in treating people who are, you know, in that older age group. Number one, they seem to be more sensitive to medications and you get a lot more response out of lower doses, which I love. But secondly, they're so important in our society in guiding the youth that are, quite frankly, seem to need a bit more of that old style, you know, to keep them on different paths and paths that they might look at and avoid making their own mistakes, maybe learning from other people's mistakes so you don't have to make them yourself. And I really think that that's very important. But my other point as well is education. Now, when doctors don't understand things, they can't put the pieces together. And if they can't put the pieces together, it is confusing. And when we are confused, we're like, this is not me, this is you. This is your fault, not my fault. We don't make mistakes. Someone else makes mistakes. And I think that's an inherent human flaw. But the purpose of education is to allow people to put together what can sometimes be a very fragmented story that often is at odds with the person sitting in front of you because they've saved up for a month to get the energy to sit in that bright room with all those people with that cold temperature. And then they're going to go home and crash for a week or two after. I've got people that are still suffering from face-to-face appointments and it's been months. And it is soul-destroying for me to have that happen as a result of our requirements for our healthcare system. But we have to see people. Wish there was another way. But the cost is so great. And they come in and they look all right. But if you don't follow up because they can't even get to the phone, well, you don't know the damage of that. And I think that if we can teach GPs about the damage, if we can help them put together the 20 or so different systems, symptoms in the different phenotypes that make up ME/CFS, then they'll develop an interest. And once you've got knowledge, then you've got interest. And once you've got interest, you've got passion. And then we get more doctors who are understanding this stuff because every doctor has patients, every GP has patients with ME/CFS. I guarantee you every single one. And, you know, it's whether we've put the pieces together and identified that. Because a lot of the times these patients will just gaslight themselves. They'll say, oh, that was just a bad day. But no, it was an ME/CFS. It was PEM. It was a crash. PEM being post-exertional malaise for people that use different terms. I'm a PEM person. I just find it easier to say. But it's really hard. And if you don't have time, you're not going to be able to get all the pieces. You're just going to get very quick snapshots. And the snapshots are not enough to put that patient together to understand what's going on. And then we rely on our patients. But thankfully, health literacy in the patient cohort is incredible now, and people are really good at putting together their own symptom profile. So
I find this patient cohort is extremely well informed, extremely well educated. They know about their disease, and yeah, it's probably the most educated patient cohort I've ever worked with. Absolutely. And they have to be because they have really been overlooked and neglected in our healthcare system for so long. And so those of them that have the capacity feel they've got to take things into their own hands. And, you know, being assertive is a really good thing for a patient, and it's a really good thing for doctors, because if you've got the energy, you can at least go and try to bat for what you feel you need. Yeah, so yeah, very important points that you make there, David. I love the comment about matriarchy as well, because I guess that goes across society as a whole, doesn't it? It's not just limited to health and ME/CFS for sure. So, getting a little bit back onto script, your work at the ME Research Clinic combines clinical care with translational research, which is so critical. How does this integrated approach help improve diagnosis and treatment options for people with ME/CFS?
So, in terms of what my clinic specifically does, it doesn't really offer much that your standard general practice clinic can offer. So it really is, you know, we don't have anything translatable at the moment that assists in diagnosis apart from education and time and being able to put people's stories together. There are a lot of mimics and other conditions that can sound a lot like ME/CFS, and there are a lot of complications that occur in parallel to ME/CFS. What the ME Research Clinic itself can do that others can't is really get so experienced in ME/CFS that we are able to find the mimics, make sure they're not happening, or identify other conditions that aren't ME/CFS related that might appear to be like. And a classic one is a patient may be going through PEM or what they think is PEM, but only someone who sees 10,000 different cases of PEM can go, you know what, this is actually not PEM and you need to go to hospital right now because this is serious. And there is a risk in people writing off their PEM or their symptoms being part of their ME/CFS when it's unrelated and that delays care. And we know that people with ME/CFS have a shortened all-cause mortality. They have all-cause mortality being higher. So their lifespan is lower because of multiple and all reasons. And that's problematic. And I think a lot of that is because we have trouble identifying different symptoms and different things that need attention. But in terms of translating, I think we're very across the different treatments that are coming out and the different studies that are emerging. And we're able to become very comfortable in going through treatment pathways, ensuring that we have reached the end of the treatment pathway that is conventional and evidence-based, and then proceed beyond into lower qualities of evidence that wouldn't traditionally be taken up by your generalist, because we need to know a lot about the illness. We need to know a lot about the treatment in order to practice in an off-label prescribing space. There is not a lot of defense. It's a very risky area to practice in and requires a lot of knowledge. And that's tough for your standard GP. We don't have algorithms because we don't have the evidence to support it, because ME/CFS itself is, for me speaking, and this is a lot about the translation, it's not one illness. It's going to be thousands of illnesses. Or it's going to be so individual that it's not even. It's basically person-specific illness. And that's what my research is. It's precision medicine. It is like if you think of cancers, where they used to be all breast cancer, but now they're triple negative, or they're this negative and that negative. It's basically saying that concept, extract it down and right down into an individual person level. And we'll talk about that a bit more later. But in terms of how we translate, it's really finding those emerging evidence-based treatments, even though the evidence is very low, and saying, hey, look, you've tried everything. Your quality of life is terrible, which means we can actually balancing off the unknown unknown. So we know things that we don't know, and then we don't know things that we don't know. And so I'm able to say, look, I know there's a lot we don't know. That could be really risky for you. But right now, what else have we got? Your quality of life is terrible. We've got to do something. Yeah. And as long as we can go through that consent procedure safely and very well supported, medico-legally speaking, then we can try treatments that are less conventional, but with emerging evidence. And that's what I say is translational at this point. And so what we're doing is we're waiting for treatments to come out. We're setting ourselves up as a space where when we've got a good treatment, we can go right on to interventional randomized controlled trials. And we're just getting ready for that time. So there's a lot going on in the clinic, but that would be the purpose of the translational part of what we do.
Yeah, sure. So recent advances in multi-omics, and maybe you'd like to explain that to our audience, and neuroimaging are promising as well. And how are these technologies helping you to understand the underlying mechanisms of ME/CFS and their related conditions? And I do want to talk in a moment a little bit about some of the related conditions and how they're seen by the medical profession. I'm particularly thinking here about mast cell activation syndrome, POTS, fibromyalgia, EDS, etc.
Yeah, so how is multi-omics coming into play here? So what we have is a very real illness. We know that from the Dubbo trial. We know that if we follow people who catch an infection, even though they have no idea what's going on, we can see them getting ME/CFS. So what we've got is a very real biological condition. What we don't know is what's going on to cause that constellation of symptoms. So there are biological processes, and it starts with the genes, so the DNA, and then it goes from the DNA to the RNA, and then from the RNA to the proteins, and from the proteins to the metabolome and the way the proteins do their work in the environment. And then the autonomics. So that's another part of the omics picture, which is basically the inherent or the nervous system that's functioning on its own, the autonomous nervous system. So we've got a lot of different systems at different levels that start from our genes into how we are literally sitting here in front of you and talking to you, sitting upright, hearts beating, lungs working, voice coming out. And so it's about looking at each step of the way and seeing how they interplay with their environment and then comparing that to other people. And so the multi-omics says, I'm going to look at your genes. Is there anything wrong with the genes? Yes or no? Maybe. Then I'm going to follow that maybe something wrong into the RNA. And has that changed? Is it translating in the way it should? Is it copying over? And then from the RNA to the protein, do we have the right amount of protein from the RNA? Is the protein functioning like it should? Is the metabolome working the way it should? And then by measuring all this stuff, we then say, look, in its environment, so using our imaging studies, is everything working in a way that it should? We're hoping, but I mean, that's basically everything or everything that we understand today. So if we look at all those steps, there's so much information. Something has to be going wrong in those steps somewhere. Let's look at it all. Let's find it out. Let's compare it to other people. Let's compare it to people themselves. Let's look at it at a cell level. Let's look at it at a broader organ level. And how can we see what's going on with that? So there are a lot of advancements. Decode Me recently came out with some really interesting stuff. There was a neuroimaging paper that used a trace for dopamine that came out 3 days ago now, which is really interesting as a concept. And all these mechanisms seem to fit with what we're observing at a cellular level. So Missalides, really great guy out of La Trobe, I think.
Daniel,
fantastic. His research, I've basically based nearly all my PhD on. I love his stuff. And he's a great guy, but I love his stuff more. It's his idea of ATP and how the mitochondria are functioning and how our systems of oxidative stress work seem to with a current model. And in our research space in Chris's lab, everyone has a different view. And Chris really lets us take our theory and prove it or disprove it. So we have a lot of research in our multi-omics way, and Associate Professor Schneider Fitzek have got some great pharmacology and metabolomic ideas of how to identify what's going on. But then what if we give people treatments and see what happens? Because this is a dynamic process. Everyone responds so differently. Their side effects, their final doses, their titration regimes are different. Maybe there's something there. So maybe we analyze them dynamically and see what happens. And that's a big part of one of our projects at the moment, the TOTEM trial, which really talks about what's happening in people's different responses. So multi-omics is huge. It is the way this is moving forwards. We are finding information, and it's information that is imminently translatable. We're going to have therapeutics from this.
Well, that's
hopefully repurposed, which is a lot easier, but yeah. Novel is hard.
Yeah, of course. So you did just quickly bypass Decode, which of course is Chris Ponting's DNA study. Is that work being furthered here in Australia? Because when those announcements came out, and Chris was one of the people that we have had on this podcast series, it seems to me that, you know, we need to keep going. And that was such a relief for patients to hear, wow, it is in the DNA. It's not in our minds.
That work is definitely being forwarded, and nearly all of our projects at the moment are incorporating that and using a lot of really interesting, I'm not sure how much I'm even allowed to talk about it, but a lot of our collaborators have some amazing stuff where they've taken that concept and used advanced computing systems to give us much more biomarkers and much more than the original DecodeMe data set. So I'm just not sure if I'm allowed to talk about it.
No, that's all right. I want you to say.
Basically, yeah. We are very much using all of that everyone in the lab is using it, and a lot of that research is awaiting publications and output. So
we're really excited.
In order to see it, it's going to be big, and it's very exciting the way we're going to use that data.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you've already talked about precision medicine. Can we talk a little bit more about your involvement in developing precision medicine frameworks, and what do you see as the future of personalized treatment for people living with ME/CFS, as we see in, you know, other conditions where you mentioned cancer at the beginning? You know, cancer has got, you know, so many different personalized treatments depending on the type of cancer, where it is, its development, et cetera. Can you talk a bit more about that, please?
Yes, of course. So precision medicine is that idea that there is a biomarker or an individuality to an illness. And it is a logical progression of medicine that we are going to move beyond syndromes or just collections of symptoms and signs, and entirely focus on one person, their phenotype, the way they express their illness in their own individual way, the way their cells, the way their genes, the way their proteins, the way everything functions, will be so individualized that it will be beyond that triple negative breast cancer concept. It will be the idea where, and this is going to sound very science fiction, but it is actually in the process of happening, we collect so much information, so much at each level, that it is too much for the human brain to really understand. And we have AI systems, huge AI systems, that put that person, they break them apart and they put them all back together digitally. And I say to this computer system, what happens if I give this person naltrexone? What happens if I give them to him straight at 5 milligrams? Will they be okay or will they have side effects? And the system goes, that's a terrible idea, mate. Drop that down, go to 0.1 milligrams and, you know, start that in a liquid prep because they do better with liquid. And I think what will happen is we will have this computer system, and the Menden Lab, fantastic researcher, Michael Menden, who focuses at Bio21 on developing these, what we call digital twins, where the person has a digital control of themselves. And I just go to the control, hey, what happens if I do this to them? And the control responds. And so what I can say is, you know, control, tell me what treatment's going to be best for this person with the least side effects. You know, they need work for their PEM. I want to reduce their PEM, you know, increase that boundary. What'll work for them? And the digital twin will say, hey, do this and this and this. These are options with the least amount of side effects. And the way we do that is we build the model. So we have to build it for each specific person. And the concept is measure people at so many different levels, collect as much data as possible in a way that a human cannot even put together, that we need these huge computing models to put the pieces together, and then try them in different ways and see what builds upon that model, what keys are needed to really advance the model in a certain way. And so we're hoping with this Totem project funded by the McCusker Foundation, OMF, and the research training program, whoever that funds the PhD, we're hoping that these people can, they're funding this idea that we're really going to make this huge progress in this model and really advance it in a conceptual, like, can this even work? And if it doesn't, maybe it needs another 20 years. And if not, look, this is a perfect condition where there's so much going on that it's so hard for a person to put together. This is perfect for a digital twin. And we're hoping that, you know, with these guys there, at least even one tiny step forwards would be huge. You know, we've seen even there was a German study that was put out a year ago that talked about a 15% improvement. All we need is 15% improvement to yield massive financial and economic benefits for people with ME/CFS. So the treatment doesn't even need to be a cure, only 15%. And you could spend hundreds of millions of dollars getting that 15% and still recover your cost. So there's a good economic argument here.
It's a huge economic argument, but, you know, just the thought of, I mean, what an aid that would be to the clinician, you know, to be able to have all of the information about the patient and then be able to say what would happen if I did this or if I did that, what the impact on the patient would be. I mean, I reckon that's amazing. The thing that comes to mind when I'm hearing you speak is data. And I'm not quite sure if you've heard, but in December this year, for the first time since 2003, the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare will be including ME/CFS in their burden of disease study. So Emerge Australia has been working with the AIHW for nearly 4 years to get that outcome. And we're very excited about that outcome. And we're just starting to do press releases about it. So, you know, data and being counted and having that data available, which is one of the reasons why we, Emerge Australia, is also promoting our OSMI registry, which, you know, is now being used by over 30 studies right around Australia, is going to be so critical to researchers like yourselves and others looking at personalized medicine and looking at, you know, how we can get predictability happening through technology. I think that's unbelievably exciting.
Very exciting. The economic analysis of MCFS has constantly been underrepresented, constantly. And even people who do phenomenal efforts to count and assess the productivity impacts of MCFS always underrecognize. They recognize how counted the population is. And this is so exciting. This is such phenomenal news because this will help us meet the politicians where they are and say, look, I've got an idea. Let's focus on productivity gains. Let's do something. You know, we can talk your language, politicians. We can talk an economic language. We're able to do that. Instead of just protesting, let's do something, you know, that you can see and you can make economic gains. And we can assess that with all your hard work and then using, you know, some of these German studies, say, look, let's invest. Let's recover some of this cost. Let's invest in therapeutics. Let's just help them a little bit, just a tiny, tiny bit. And watch how that helps you guys, you politicians. So, you know, this is such an important step that you've done. Honestly, it's so heartwarming to see such a big impact from Emerge because it's, I think this will be one of the biggest things, the biggest leaps that the country's done in terms of counting things. So it's really exciting to see.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I'm going to switch a little bit to the healthcare system. So we know that people with severe ME/CFS have profound symptoms that make it very difficult to access healthcare, which is a huge advocacy issue, another issue that we've been hammering with the minister. From your perspective, what are the specific needs of these individuals and how can the healthcare system better support them?
So there's an interesting discussion here. There's levels of severe. So I think there's severe and stable and there's severe and unstable. So I'm going to assume we're talking about severe and stable because severe and unstable needs a lot of advocacy from a GP and even the hospital GP liaisons to make sure that patients don't get just sort of sent home and ignored. There's a lot of advocacy and it's unremunerated work and it takes a lot. And a lot of GPs will do a lot of advocacy for people. It's a common part of our work, but it's hard. The level that is required for a severe and unstable is really complicated. And thankfully in Melbourne specifically, there are groups of people like Chris Schneider, who's so great at stabilizing unstable ME/CFS, particularly when nutritional deficiencies need to be fixed before anything. You can't make anyone better if the weight's dropping and the nutrition and fluids are out. You can't do anything. So he's been really, really good at supporting us in making some, in sort of turning some of those around. But for the severes, how do we really look after them? This is a tough situation. Okay, because this requires varying communication methods. It requires home visits. It requires dealing with carers instead of patients, looking after patients, and is really multimodal. So, and the problem is that that sounds like a capitation model would work for them, where basically doctors get funded per patient. That's not going to work here at all. In fact, that would be a UK system, and that would almost be the end of this population because they will end up, if we capitation then gets, it's very easy to cut costs. And we're not going to talk about that. But what we're going to talk about is if we capitate, if we have funding per person, who's going to go out and see the patient? It won't be the doctor. It won't. It will be whoever is cheapest. And this population is so complicated and it needs so much understanding of systems and like really biological systems, pharmacological, social. It's something that a GP is specifically trained to do. And they really need GP-specific care with occasional allied and not allied-centered. So what we need is we need nursing to go out and do fluids for when their fluids are dropping, standing tests. We need nurses and pharmacists to go out and check medicines and compliance, different routes, what works best. We need OTs for house modification. We need exercise physiologists for pacing, and pacing is so important. The funding needs to be blocked, but if we block, they will definitely end up worse. So I can't think of a way that is the answer. If you ask me how I would be doing this, that I'd be shifting the focus away from short, quick, episodic care to acknowledgement that what we need is basically the safety net and people are going to have to contribute to their healthcare in a very uncomfortable way. But at some point, that stops and then the government picks up the rest of the cost, like you would with an insurance. You know, you've got a premium and then you've got your gap or whatever it's called. So that really needs to be the way we move towards it, in my personal opinion, in seeing what would work best. But if you ask me, there is so much that needs to be done. And I think the goal is really to think about people as a unit, not just as an individual, but when that person is being cared for by the children, by partners, if we think of everyone together, how can we support everyone so that productivity is the goal? And this is awful economic discussion, but if we have productivity as the goal, can we reduce the amount of caring hours from family so that they get a bit of time, they can go and do education, they can get a high-paying job, they can contribute more to the country? Can we have carers that are understanding of people so that a person with ME/CFS doesn't have to direct and instruct at every step of the way because it's so draining for them in NDIS to have to tell people, all right, can you go and do this and then do that and then do that? We're in a difficult situation in how to manage these severe ME people because they need so much care. The family needs care and we cannot neglect them. They are us. We could all be that. And the fact that we neglect them means that at some point when we need care, when our children need something like that, well, they're not going to have it. And, you know, we need to look after everyone in our society. So I think that there are different arguments, but in order for severe ME to be looked after, it's multimodal. It is. There's a lot of stuff. It's really, really complicated.
You raise some hugely important issues that I don't have the time to cover in this podcast, but would like to have a discussion with you at some stage. I do want to touch on telehealth because what we're told by severe ME patients is that some of them actually don't even go and see their doctor as a result of the requirement for them to have one face-to-face visit a year. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because on the one hand, I actually understand that from a clinician's perspective, seeing a patient face-to-face is really important. But I don't understand why that visit couldn't end up being a home visit rather than the patient who's severe, let's say who has no family support, who is on their own, as so many of our severe patients are, couldn't have a home visit.
So what you raise is true. They could have a home visit, and that's commonly what we'll do, depending on how far out. So I think the issue with the home visit is, for me, a home visit is a whole day off to go and see the person. You've got to drive out there. You've got to pack up all your things. You've got to go out. You've got to make it useful. So there's no point going out and doing a 10-minute consultation. So you've got to do all that stuff. You've got to see them. And then you've got to come home and you've got to write your notes. So quite commonly, you're looking at a couple of hours that's out to see them. The government does not contribute extra at all for it, basically. I think it's an extra $10 or something, or $5 for a home visit, which these days won't even cover the petrol for anyone that's not in the immediate vicinity. But then what you have is a discussion about equity. And what that means is, if I go and see this person for that home visit, how many people don't get seen on that day? And this is a horrible discussion because no one really wants to talk about health equity and inequity in the ME/CFS population. But how do we divide up expertise in our care in a way that gives the best care for the most people? And I think that that's what really hurts home visits at the moment. They've been defunded quite significantly recently, which has hurt people. And the issue is as well is we need to see people. There is a lot more to seeing someone face-to-face and examining them. We should be seeing them once a year. They should be home visits. But how do we do that with the equity of health, and how do we make sure that it is not a cost-loss procedure? Because quite commonly, even just if you say 4 hours, well, that's not going to cover rent and like the rebate won't cover rent and software at all. So it's not even cost neutral. You'd basically say it's charity work to go and do it. So it's cost loss for a clinic. And even if you've got very low overheads, it's still really, really difficult. And what do you do? Charge plumber rates? You know, it's huge. A call out for a plumber is $250 at the moment. So that's just on top of the home visit. So, you know, and once you charge for that, you can't get the rebate. And if you're in a bulk billing clinic that is coupled with never charging a patient at all, once one person in the clinic charges a patient, then the whole clinic loses, I think it's 12 and a half or a very big chunk of a bulk billing incentive. So you doing that one home visit and trying not to make it a cost loss could destroy the whole clinic even just with one patient. So I think the system is complicated. I love that we'd have, we need home visits. We need to. You know, GPs used to do home visits all the time. I remember when I first started doing research, I looked at the home visit rebates and you could just see this exponential reduction in how people would do it. And then now no one does them at all. And they're not, you know, sometimes they're actually not even safe. When I was at Frankston, someone got attacked by a dog doing a home visit. And that really made me quite anxious with home visits at the best of times. So,
I mean, I really understand that because many moons ago, I was a social worker and I worked in education. This is a lifetime ago now, but I had to do home visits and occasionally I would go into a household that was dangerous and I was on my own. And I only did that a couple of times and decided that I either have to take someone with me or I don't do them. So I totally understand the fears and the risks, I guess, associated. But how do you find telehealth then? Because so many of our patients that provide us with input and feedback, you know, rely on telehealth.
So in my model, it's a really good question as well, because how do we do telehealth and how do I as a practitioner feel that it plays in? It's good. It's fantastic. It's not perfect. And we miss a lot. We can't examine people and there's inherent risk in not examining people. But I'm a pragmatist and I think that we can't have everything being perfect. We have to take somehow a middle ground. And I think telehealth does provide that. Video is a bit better because we get longer rebates. But it'd be great if we had something for email communication as well, because that seems to be a fantastic way of communicating with people with NE.
Yeah, I've not thought of that, but so many of our people communicate so well in writing, you know, online, emails to us. We get emails all the time. And yeah, I've never heard that stated by anyone.
It would be exciting to see that covered. But once again, if we tried to put that in, what would be very concerning is I suspect that we'd end up towards a block funding. But no, it's fantastic. And for a lot of my severe cases, we'll, you know, just communicate in writing and then every now and then do a telehealth. And what I try to do is I say, look, I've got fees and the fees allow for me just as a block, basically. And I just say, look, that's how much I'm going to make. And then that allows me to do written communication for a lot of patients. But I think with AI, speech to text, it allows people to even type without having to tap with their hands. So it's less tactile, less thinking, and it can organize their thoughts really nicely. So we get a lot of that. But I think telehealth as well has some interesting options where there's a lot of passive monitoring and passive things that we could do to assess patients and how they're improving and worsening. And a lot of that needs to be done in staggered ways. So what I'm hoping is, you know, for what I do is I have questionnaires that I use part of my PhD, but it's also part of seeing how their functional capacity is changing according to their state and what we do. And so I use that and I can look at it before the consultation and keep the consultation shorter. But I'm also very reliant in my model on their local GP and then having access to their local GP to really make sure that if there's some sort of catastrophe, they can go there and be assessed and they don't have to get in the car and travel from one faggy to Melbourne. And what I try to do is always write back to the GP so that they know what's going on. And then what we've got is this nice little communication where, you know, the telehealth is a part of this patient's treatment and not all of the treatment, because that's the problem. When that is all, that's very suboptimal care. But, you know, suboptimal is better than nothing, you know, and I will take, and unfortunately people with ME will take whatever they can do, which is really sad, but they're usually quite grateful to just have anything. I wish it was a little bit better.
It's really not good enough, is it? But with someone like yourself who really, really genuinely wants to make things better, we just wish that there were more doctors around like that. We know that there are many who are concerned, but, you know, near enough really isn't good enough for anyone with medical care. And I guess that brings me to my final two questions. One is around, I guess, earlier and better recognition and support for patients with ME/CFS, which really touches to, you know, what can the average doctor that may not know a lot about ME/CFS do to recognize ME/CFS earlier so that patients can be diagnosed as soon as possible? And that's as much of a practical question as it is actually a medical question.
And it is such a wonderful question. And the reason I say that is because I have had patients myself, and this is, and keep in mind, I've been researching this my whole life, is this basically. And even with myself, I have had patients get an acute illness and then get something like a postherpetic neuralgia and then something else. And it took far too long, months, for me to realize we were in an ME/CFS situation. Because it's insidious and it's slow and it's a fading. Even when it's really obvious, it's not until you really take stock and turn around and go, you know what, wait a minute, my God, look at how much you've changed in the last 6-12 months. And if you're overburdened with patients, you've got 100 different patients, how are you, or 1,000 different patients, how are you going to remember that person? And that, you know, it really relies on the relationship of the GP, of the person, and seeing that one specific GP on repeat, for that GP to go, my God, look how you've changed. Something's off. Something's really wrong here. There's something more that we're missing. So my first thing is, how do GPs identify it and how can patients play into that? We've got to have one GP, someone that we like, someone that we trust, but stick with that person. See them even if you're not terribly unwell, just regular check-ins, even if that's once a year or every 6 months, check-in so that they know you, you know them. When something's off, they can pick it up. So that's the first step. Now, the next step is, we talk about digital twins and we talk about technology and how that interplays with managing patients. So the question is, the final step is really the AI and the final step is the digital twins. But there is a few intermediate steps of the integration of technology into practice. And what a lot of us are using at the moment is something called Heidi, which is an AI transcription service. But Heidi have started to put in something that integrates evidence within the clinical consultation. And that is where this really shines. Because as we're accumulating stories, there are little symptoms that are coming out. We're not quite attributing significance because the patient doesn't attribute huge significance to it. But what the AI can do is pull out all those little things and slot them into a, this person has a little bit of light sensitivity, this person has some gut problems, this person has some autonomics, they get a bit dizzy. It can put it all together. And what we're finding with this pyramid, basically, of expanding technology within to the clinic is the AI will actually start to provide us with diagnoses soonish as people come on. And what we can do is we can actually synthesize evidence within the consultation itself at the moment and say, give me a differential diagnosis. What are 5 different things that could be going on here with these varying symptoms? And especially if we don't know, that can actually help us with thinking outside the box. And maybe it's not anxiety and dehydration and a pain syndrome. Maybe it's all actually ME/CFS with autonomic instability. And I think that the integration is going to be really useful for GPs. And I think that that's actually going to really assist in diagnosis soon. And I would say that could even happen now because, you know, I can do that with my Heidi program. So that's how it's going to assist. How that interplays right now, you know, I'd say, look, if you've got a difficult patient, you don't know what's going on, do a health assessment, you know, do a GP management plan and try and put all those symptoms together. They come in with logbooks, you know, annotate it. Let's put that all in together and let's try and see if there's something that we don't know and get a broader differentials. And I'd be thinking that we could do that. And I think that will be happening in the next even few years. And that'll have quite a meaningful impact on people with ME/CFS who are undiagnosed.
That is amazing. I loved your comment on maybe it is CFS when you might be looking at something else. And the reason I say that and I'm interested, prick my ears up is we both just went to the POTS conference where, interestingly enough, until your presentation came up, there was no mention of ME/CFS. And I guess that makes me a little bit concerned because, of course, orthostatic intolerance is a part of ME/CFS for some patients, not all, but some. And there seems to be a separation of POTS, which is, of course, can be seen in the cardiovascular space, from ME/CFS. And I'm a bit concerned about that. Have you got any thoughts on that?
I think we get to this situation where, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. This situation where we sort of see what we experts in. And, you know, like the MCAS people will see MCAS in ME/CFS because we have mast cell dysfunction. The POTS people see POTS. And, you know, they don't think of the MCAS or the other. But what happens is everyone's just trying to treat people and do their best in what they're experts in. And I think that that's really interesting because even just treating orthostatic intolerance can make a very significant impact for people with ME/CFS. In fact, as soon as I see POTS, part of me just relaxes slightly because it's so much easier to treat as a pathway than ME/CFS as a whole. I think the POTS people, they know. You know, and to me, a big part of me thinks that, you know, we're separating out things that are just, their POTS is just more predominant than their other symptoms. But we all have varying degrees of mast cell activation issues, varying degrees of autonomic instability. And I think that the POTS conference was this incredible joining of all these different people. But, you know, learning about POTS is our easiest way to make a meaningful treatment for people with ME/CFS. What I wouldn't want to see is people with ME/CFS not getting treatment because they didn't meet the criteria for POTS, though. Dennis Lau's done a lot of work on that recently about having this sort of sub-threshold POTS. And I'm sure that Jason would have spoken about that last week because I know that's one of his big things. But and the hypermobility as well. It's like there is something going on that joins all of these. We don't know what it is. And what we do find is that everyone is expressing varying levels of it. And I think that it's just treatment pathways and treatment targets for different people. So, you know, even just, it's also so much easier to treat with POTS. It's so much more visible. There is that very clear biomarker of tachycardia. And it's so visible. So it is, if you ask me, it is a long journey. You know, we're amongst like ice and icebergs and they're like the icebreaker and they're sort of going through and they're making the waves and they're breaking the ice for us to come in after. And POTS for clinicians is just such an easy way to get them to, oh, have you thought about fatigue and have you thought about this? And it breaks the ice because they can see it. They can learn about it. There's three treatments that are really easy and they can prescribe that they know about. And then we can, you know, start to work in that space behind this icebreaker and really use that. And even though we probably represent a much bigger financial impact and loss in terms of quality of life than POTS without ME, I think that the visibility of POTS is just going to be wonderful for us. Just like long COVID was just so visible. So, you know, big outbreak, just bang. You know, half these people just disappearing from society because they've got long COVID, or, you know, for those that got, you know, ME/CFS from their long COVID, like, it's just so visible that it opens the energy limiting space, and we can work with that. You know, we have to be pragmatic and just take whatever we can get.
Yep.
But I did love that conference. It was amazing.
Okay, so we're coming to our last question, and can I just ask you what messages of hope and inspiration you'd like to share with our audience to help them feel seen, supported, and empowered?
So for our audience, the messages of hope, there is so much research going on at the moment. There are amazing things coming out. We've got Natalie in our research group, Steroidomic Study, the Mello trial, there's our imaging, the LOPUS trial. There is so much stuff, and there is so much progress. There is more progress in the last 5 years than there's probably been in the last 30, 40, or even 50 years for this condition. There is hope, and I don't know how quick it's going to come, but there is so much stuff that is happening that I think is going to make an impact, that I need you guys just to hold on a little bit longer and have hope. And be engaged, and be engaged with research, be engaged with advocacy where you can. And if with research that's only as simple as spreading a paper or a trial that's going on to someone who might have the capacity to actually do it, get involved in some way. But beyond that, the GP group and the medical community is changing. And it's changing quickly. We have now the ELPIC, the Energy Limiting Post-Infectious Conditions Group, with Bernard and Jenny and Jason and Sarah. And these guys, we're spreading the word. We're training the GPs. We're creating a space where people know about some of the less commonly used treatments, and we're giving them the confidence to use it. And with every GP or practitioner that works there, that writes a letter to a different GP or a different specialist that sees these treatments and can visibly see you change, there will be more acknowledgement. There will be more progress. And it is a work in progress, but there is a lot of progress. And we are functionally making change. And that's going to be seen by you guys soon. But what I need you to do is just hold on. Be engaged with our communities as much as you can. There is a lot of research databases that you can be part of. There's NDIS changes. They look scary. We will work on that. Anne's got some great stuff going, but they're functional assessments. Technically, this should be great for us. And I'm hoping that as time goes on, we will have something that, even if there's no cure, there is progress, there is understanding, there is hope, and at least you'll be able to see someone and see a GP or a specialist, and they won't just go, oh, you're crazy. They'll go, oh, you've got ME/CFS. That is a horrible condition. I'm sorry you've got that. Let's work on why you're here today. And I'm hoping that that is something that you hear more and more of every time you have an encounter with health, because there's a lot of healing that we all need to do as a group. And I'd love it if I never heard that word medical gaslighting again, because it is awful as a word, as a concept, and for people who have felt it, because I think that scars a lot of us, and we can do work for that. We could heal that scar. So there is hope, and I really like it. We've got articles coming out in general practice magazines. We've got assessments that, quite frankly, the GP examinations base a lot of their assessments on these magazines. So you're going to see this. If you've got a GP that you like, see them, even if you're not terribly unwell. If you don't like your GP, it's horses for courses. Find someone else. You can find someone who understands and works with you. See them regularly. Let them know who you are, for good or bad. And just be connected in some way, because it's so isolating, this illness, and just human connection can have a big, profound impact. And please, if you don't have a shower chair as well, get a shower chair. They're just so much energy saving. Please, shower chairs. That's my final message.
Thank you, David. I mean, I was inspired by your final message, and I'm sure that our listeners will be as well. So, Dr. David Feinberg, you've given us an amazing podcast. Thank you so much for your time and for participating in this important series during Severe ME Week. To those listening, we hope you have enjoyed this interview. Tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information, to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, or to find out ways in which you can support our work, visit our website on emerge.org.au and look out for our Count ME campaign. And that is also designed to ensure that the work of Emerge Australia continues, particularly our patient services, at a time when funding is not guaranteed. So we'd really appreciate your support. Thank you, David, once again, and bye for now.
Thank you very much.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join.